The evidence is on the deterioration of environment, basically. You need to update it and to keep some notes on it yourself. And it's best done from actual published references. So that's the only negative part of the course, actually. When you give a two-day course, you shouldn't waste more than half an hour on it. If you give a course like this, you can waste half a day on it. And if you are talking to people just for an hour or two, you can just make reference to one thing and say, well, that's just an instance of how things are. But we don't dwell on the evidence and the negative aspects, because there is enough evidence of the need to act. We don't need any more evidence, and I would discourage anybody going out and finding any more evidence of deterioration of the environment. You're just wasting your time. The environment's on the downhill slide. Nobody doubts it anymore. And what we need to do is to waste our time on positive action, not on getting more evidence. Let's take we deal, if you like, with wind, water, or air, water, soil, and forests. There are four areas. And if you like, politics, which is another sad area. The air and the water in the air, carried by the air, are the direct transporters of pollutants around the planet. The air carries, from water, a lot of modern chemicals co-distilled. DDT is just one of them. The water is, well, it's nature's greatest solvent. There's not much that isn't soluble in water. What isn't soluble is often transported in water. So water and air are carrying most substances through both hemispheres. The thing that has come up of recent years, maybe in the last 8 years, 5 to 8 years, is the one that we concentrate on a little bit as an example is acid rain. And I'll explain why that happens and what it is. The acids in rain are two: sulfuric
and nitric acid.
The sulfuric acid comes from the burning of coal, oil, and some natural gas.
Nitric acid
from the exhaust of motor vehicles. The sulfuric acid travels in air streams as sulfur particles called an aerosol. Those particles are very small, they're very few you across, and they travel freely in the global atmosphere, and they will settle out in forests and in very quiet periods of quiet airstream. They'll settle out on the ground and you get what they call a dry sulfur, a fallout. It's very pronounced here when we get winds from Melbourne or from Victoria. When we get the rare north easterly winds, our air pollution monitoring station goes off the graph. That's at Cape Grim. When these particles are in the air, they cause cloudiness because water condenses on them. However, they're too small for them to cause rain. And the result on the world's climate is now measurable. The climate of the Earth is much cloudier and much drier than it has been in history. So throughout Europe and America, you get a lot of clouds, but hardly any rain. When rain falls, it falls as a weak acid. Now, rain is normally a weak acid, and the 7 is neutral on the pH scale. It's just a hydrogen ion concentration, and this is a logarithmic scale, so 8 is 10 times as alkaline as 7. And we're not much worried about natural alkalinities above 11. This is baking soda and coastal lagoons. And about 9, that's desert soils. 8 to 9 is a typical desert soil, 7.5 to 9.5, somewhere there. 7 is 7.5 to 6.5 is what we would call garden soil. And this is 10 times more acid than 7. And this is 10 times more acid than 6. And 1 is concentrated sulfuric acid. 3 is vinegar, ordinary vinegar. The highest natural acidity is 2.2, is lime juice. These would be the pHs, 4.5 to 5.5, of peat bogs and of the swamp at Stanley, for instance, where you see that deep brown water coming out of peat. Now, you can set yourself out a logarithmic scale. When you do it, draw a little line down the left, if that's your page. Draw your little line down the left-hand side and put 1 to 11, the 7, and then do a logarithmic scale. So this is increasing alkalinity, and that is increasing acidity. So you're not in any mistake that pH 5 is just a little bit more acid than pH 6. It's 10 times more. So from 7, that's 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, right? 100,000 times more acid. So you see that on that scale, whereas you don't see it on the left-hand side in the table. And then make yourself some little lines across and put natural substances and other substances and then effects. Now, there's a critical point here at pH 4.5. That's the point at which unprotected cells die normally. Fish eggs do not hatch. Frogs and other wet-skinned animals die. Salamanders, frogs, slugs, they can't stand pH 4, 5 or below. The gardens, there's a few plants that don't mind this pH, and they are few. There's sort of blueberry, potato, maybe another 4 or 5. But most plants need a pH of 5.5 to 7.5, and our garden is best off just slightly acid. Now, a normal rain is at 5.5. And the natural acidity is carbonic acid from the CO2 in the air. And carbonic acid is a beneficial acid to plant growth. And carbonic acid is a very weak acid. And it brings out plant nutrients. It takes humus and other things into solution, makes them available. Right, and when we say acid rain, we mean rain at less than pH 5.5. Rain is already acid. It has to be more acid than that. I would give you an average rainfall for the United States of 3.8.
average United States. Of Berlin, 2.8. Extremes, 1.6, measured by myself in Vermont in snow, and 1.9 measured in specific falls of rain in industrial regions. So the worst acid rain comes down at 1.6, that is, you can't walk around in that without gum boots and rubber clothing. Most clothing will dissolve, it has dissolved in that. There's cases of people losing their clothes in such rain. The 2.8. You have to explain all this to people because pH is not an easy concept because it's logarithmic scale. Even I have to sort of build this up to get a clearer understanding of it. But anyhow, with all these little bits of stuff, I'm sure you see it all. Uh, 3.8 is falling out on very isolated islands like on Mauna Lea on central desert regions and so on. So that 3.8 acidity is more or less likely to fall out anywhere in the world. At about 3, we find it fairly impossible to drink the water, and yet some water runs downstream at pH 2, say, on the Brazilian highlands inland from the coal mines. Any lake that dips below 4.5 is effectively dead. Now, it doesn't mean that it may stay all the year at 4.5, but it means it has gone below 4.5 for a period of the year. It's like fish in a stream. If the stream doesn't flow and dries up, it only has to do it once a year and there's no fish in the stream. It doesn't matter the fish, whether it's flopping around on dry land for half an hour or for 10 days. The same with acidity. If the lake dips below 4.5, the fish die, and it doesn't matter if it just does that for half an hour a year. There are now some 80,000 lakes in the world that dip below 4.5 annually. About 20,000 of them are permanently below that point. Many of those lakes have never really been visited by people. They're in the Adirondack Mountains, remote reserves. They are throughout mountainous and unvisited regions. Tasmania has 4,200 lakes on the high plateau. Most of them wouldn't see a person all year. But many of them may have dipped below 4.5. The lakes that are acidic are perfectly clear. They're not turbid because they don't carry silt. It coalesces in them. They will contain leaves but no living things. There's no longer any biological breakdown in those lakes. In effect, they're a pickle system. Fishermen still fish in them and they still issue licenses for them because they still look good. But there is no fish in them. Fishermen never expect to catch a fish anyhow. They still issue licences and they don't tell the fishermen that there's no longer any fish. No, it's in the world and will give you some particular bad regions. The rivers run and the groundwaters in rain in areas where downwind from coal burning systems run at pH 4 roughly. So you expect to find moving water at a slightly higher pH than the lakes. At pH 4, something interesting starts to happen to the water. Until it reaches that point,
it doesn't dissolve out heavy metals from the ground rocks. But at about pH 4 or 5, it starts to dissolve out these four metals preferentially: lead, mercury, cadmium, and selenium. So if the country rock contains those four heavy metals, they start to dissolve. At pH 4 and just below it, another metal starts to dissolve out, and that's aluminium, or aluminum if you're talking to a North American audience. Aluminium starts to dissolve out of the rock below pH 4. Now, aluminium is the main constituent of soils. Soils are mainly aluminium oxides or hydroxides. Aluminium bound in soils is a harmless substance. Aluminium in a sulfuric acid solution is a plant poison. As a buffering of the areas on which fallout ceases, that is, as the soils fail to offset the acidity, the roots of the forest start to take up aluminium. About 5 years later, that forest will die. Crops also take up aluminium, and crop deterioration sets in. You can lime crops, and you can lime lakes, and you can lime the forests. But Sweden has found that the cost of trying to lime her forests is greater than the product of industry. So now you're on a funny kick. It costs you more to offset, because when you're looking at pH 4, you're looking at something, you get it back here, you've got an awful big gap to come back. And so far they have not been able to revive one lake. It's proved impossible for them to apply enough lime in a lake to bring it back to life. So far, even despite quite desperate energies, they haven't actually been able to re-establish life in the lake. The problem turned up first in the Northern Hemisphere, where there are fairly thin soils and naturally acidic systems. But it is becoming a more generalised problem. The buffering certainly was under attack by 1920. Now, in 1920, certain species of trees started to die out in the Northern Hemisphere. It was then that all the chestnuts of North America collapsed and died. They were 80% of the total deciduous forest. By 1980, several species of trees have disappeared from the North Hemisphere ecosystems, and many more are disappearing. And it's extremely doubtful whether by 1990 there will be any forest in the Northern Hemisphere. The tree death we can put down to this is running between 30 and 20% per annum of standing trees. So you have a compound effect between the air, the water, and the forests and the soils. We can't disentangle this, and now we come to the politics. The reason why this is happening is that people are running around in cars like blowflies and using too much electrical energy from coal-burning systems. Politically, it's almost, first of all, they put bans on talking about it in the United States on the research. It wasn't published. Then they refused to take any notice of Canadians. So the Canadians had to, and I think the Swedes, started international lawsuits against the polluting nations, the most polluting nations. However, as this is a national problem that goes right across all boundaries of all nations, it's very difficult. You really want a total international agreement. Now, take Sweden. 85% of her
rain input comes, acid rain comes from Britain. The rest of it comes from Czechoslovakia in the Eastern Bloc. Now, Poland gets an awful dose of acid rain from West Germany. And Russia gets it from everywhere because it goes on across to the west. The acid rain produced in around the Great Lakes region of the United States reaches Ireland. The acid rain produced in the Jose region of Brazil drifts inland into the Amazon, falling first on the Serra do Mar. The acid rain produced by Melbourne and Sydney goes inland and comes across Bass Strait and so on. Los Angeles produces enough hydrochloric acid from motor vehicle exhausts to affect areas directly about 180 miles downwind. There we have a problem. I'll state it in short for you. If we continue to use motor vehicles and burn coal and oil, we will not be able to inhabit the earth for very much longer. So neither coal, oil, nor motor vehicles, nor in fact some polluted natural gases are possible energy sources. Those sources are not possible to us. That would leave atomic power. Atomic power gives off a whole range of radioactives from plutonium to iodine-131, mainly as very fine particle matter which goes off in the air or in water. At Three Mile Island they had three gas releases, one of which went roughly like that from Three Mile Island early in the feast. This is the Canadian border, here's New York. I-131 levels rose very steeply right across those fallout areas, as they did in Australia during the French tests. Iodine is taken up mainly by our thyroid glands. The I-131 falls on the grass, is taken to cattle, concentrated thousands of times in milk, ingested by people in milk in particular, concentrates in the thyroid, and when the thyroid is building itself, when it's active in young people, it causes a condition with hyperthyroidosis. Meaning deterioration of the thyroid gland. This is one of the effects of radioactive drift. In the early atomic bomb tests in New Mexico, a drift cloud came in over Los Angeles and got trapped for 18 days under an inversion layer in the town, so that in Los Angeles, all the people of Los Angeles were living in a radioactive cloud for that length of time. The Professor Emeritus at the School of Health and Medicine in Los Angeles recently stated that there will be some 30 to 60,000 deaths of hyperthyroidosis attributable to that few days of radioactivity. The Canadians estimate, and have published an estimate of some 30,000 children already dead under these drift clouds of hyperthyroidosis and allied diseases. It doesn't appear as though nuclear devices are any safer to people or to living things than coal or gas or oil. The other problems that arise is that even these low levels of radioactivity destroy the immune response in both plants and animals. So you'll see a very steep rise in reactivity to the substances to which we asthma, all that sort of thing, rises steeply because the immune response is damaged by a damage to the thyroid partly and to other organs. Perhaps the worst aspect, however, may be a longer term one of plutonium, of which there's already enough missing to give everybody in the world a cancer. We're only one particle of that stuff. It doesn't seem as though nuclear power promises us much else. Hydroelectric power provides 8% of the world's energy. Sometimes 5, sometimes 100, but on average 8. That would be more than sufficient to run all the towns and domestic appliances in any society. It won't run motor vehicles. We might state the problem as how can society reduce its energy requirements to 8% of its current requirements and get its power from wind or water. Not far from Livermore in California, there's a wind farm established by the issuing of bonds by a utility and established purely by private investment. You can have $100 in it. It promises to have an output equivalent to an atomic power station by the middle of next year. And it's not very many wind. It's not very much of a thing. It's quite small. And its cost has been somewhere near 20th or something of an atomic energy station. Wind is a possible energy system. Water is a possible energy system. And there are biological energy systems. We will be dealing with these. They suffer from a serious defect politically, is that they are sometimes difficult to centralise and therefore to control. Therefore, the real problem we're facing is a political problem, where in Tasmania a government will invest $80 million in highways, just increasing an acid rain problem, and no money whatsoever in altering the balance of domestic energy within houses. Exactly the same money spent in insulation would mean you don't have to generate any more energy for this population. A government that will spend, you know, $500 million putting up a dam will not help its own people in their homes. Politics obviously is a central problem, and I don't make any difference between ultra-right-wing fascist governments and ultra-left-wing governments at all, none at all. They are both concerned only with one thing, the maintenance of centralised power systems. Both are, and both are also devoted to one other thing which is also fatal, and that is the increase of the GNP, or the gross national product. Now both of those will kill us. Now I don't overstate this problem, I simply point out to you that you want to cut your way clearly through the mass of crap in the world and go straight to the central problem. And here it is, really. Now, do you want to add to that evidence or take any exception to some of it or a comment at all or ask a question to clarify?
How did
you assess the pH? Oh, we were at college and we had pH papers. We took out a fresh snowfall one evening and got a pH of 1.3, which we didn't believe, so we took it down and titrated it three times, but three different titrations in the laboratory. Well, the real problem may very well come down to what Barry Jones said in Hobart yesterday. He said that when you look at the educational type of background of modern politicians, for instance, all Tasmanian politicians, none of this actually is even understandable by them. So what you're doing, we've elected several footballers in Tasmania and a lot of corner shopkeepers the pH scale is a total unknown. They just see jobs for the boys and votes in their district. I was in Brazil when the scientists showed me the map of pH. They'd written a very good report on it for the government, and the local, the minister, who's a military man, went up to the affected area where people are trying to drink water at pH 2 and promised them a new football ground and got re-elected. I want to mention a secondary effect. Yes, it's a secondary effect. About here somewhere, about 5.5, 5.8, there's a sex ratio of male to female birth alters dramatically in favour of male birth. French have measured that. It's across all mammals. Yes, about 5.5. It corresponds to a natural cycle, ovulation cycle, pH. However, if you're leaving on an acid base, you become acidic. Anxiety levels rise and aggressive behaviour rises as the body chemistry tries to cope with increasing pH. So anxious, aggressive, masculine people arise here. There's also a qualitative effect as well as a quantitative effect in that we get what you could describe as masculinized females. No. Up here, 8.5 to 9, we had the opposite problem. Iron, zinc, and quite a lot of necessary minerals are not available to plants. They're locked into the soil structure. And that is, we'll deal with that in dry land systems. We're looking at a mineral deficiency for plants here. The best area for plants is in here. All minerals are available in the quantities that plants need them. Here they become, some minerals become available which plants don't need, and here, minerals which are poisonous to plants. Up here, you're getting to the stage where only very few specialised plants can actually extract any mineral at all.
So does acid rain
change the list? Yes, acid rain makes the minerals plant soluble. Soluble for plant uptake. So if you've got all that clear, that's one factor. Right. So we won't dwell on that. That's enough to depress you.
How much the world surface is covered by the alkaline pHs and how much by the acid?
The deserts are alkaline generally. That's not true of all deserts, but mostly it is. The occupied areas of agriculture and the glaciated areas and the high areas are the main ones that suffer from acidity. Well, yes, it would. It would completely transform the vegetation, and there would maybe be not much genetic base for that transformation. A lot of the animals and plants in the deserts are adapted to this tolerance. We want to move a citrus tree into the desert, we've got to bring in ferric sulfate. We've got to acidify the desert. So if you acidify the desert and don't bring in trees or plants that are adaptable, the local plants won't grow. So, in any case, there's no point in our... Most of the human population resides here where the acid rain is an effect. Almost all of us live in those humid areas, not in the arid areas. very tiny proportion of the world's population live in arid areas. Less than 2% of us. So acid rain affects about 98% of humanity then. Yes, well we're up on the edge of we're up on the brick wall end of a long ongoing deterioration. Right, good, that's good, you've got all that straight. And you'll see then what we're trying to do with this evidence is to give some reason as why we need to do anything at all, why we shouldn't just go home and continue on looking forward to retirement and 65% of our pension, or whatever we look forward to. Or I hear lots of people running off, you know, saying, well, I'm going to do another 3 years and get a second nursing certificate and then I'll go and look after orphans or something. It's all total unrealism. Right. But I don't say anything about that. I say go for it. But I don't think that's what I'm going to do. Right. Now, I want to look at the water position in the world, in a world sense. I want to talk in particular about a thing called potable water. Potable. Potable water. Water that can be used in the preparation of food and to be directly ingested by human beings. Now that water has a lot of quality levels that apply to it. Of course, radioactives are not welcome in it. Asbestos particles are not welcome in it. Certain organisms such as E. coli, Escherichia coli, are regularly monitored in that water. Heavy metals have very low tolerance levels for ingestion, and water containing lead, cadmium, too much selenium, all are fairly dangerous waters. And the last category of things are chlorinated hydrocarbons, PCBs, PBBs, dioxins, so on. And there are some 2,000 of those, of which levels have been set for human ingestion, of which some 6,000 were passed by a laboratory in the United States, the only one that cleared them. It proves that they were telling lies about them. So they're a doubtful group of pollutants. Right, so water that is free from radioactives, excessive heavy metals and chlorinated hydrocarbons and radioactive substances, as I said before, is drinkable. We can't find any of that water in the United States. There is no such water. Drinkable water is almost extinct. Why is that? If we look at that as a land surface, call this the OD'd world, or the overdeveloped world. I don't know what other people call it, but I call it the OD'd world. We call that the third world, or whatever you like to call it. The end-to-be-deed world, the never-to-be-developed world. And this is the earth, and this is the air. We have three poisonous cycles. In the OD'd world, since 1940, farmers have been laying on a beautiful sequence of chemicals on the ground. Not just annually, but up to 20, 30 times per annum on a single crop. These have been following the normal infiltration route and descending into the groundwater, and are still being laid on top. So this strata are descending into the earth. Now, they also start to move in the groundwaters, and they're moving much faster than people thought. They're going at least 30 miles a year. At the same time, other substances, particularly radioactives, have been disposed of by deep pumping and also have been released into surface streams. So they too are moving into the groundwaters. So this circle of poison, now, say we take a well and pump out of it at this point.
Could you come again on the thing on the left of the well?
Oh, here. In various wells, which are disposal pits, for instance, all radioactives in the United States are held in lagoon systems. They're not sealed lagoons. And they have it net downward infiltration transfer. Some of those lagoons are close to fission point, actually. There's so much plutonium they can might spontaneously go up. So they found that they were so close to that they had to hurriedly build the levees and to pump them out and dilute them and make other lagoons. They actually make an atomic bomb in the open. Right. Anyhow, all these have seeped into the groundwaters. There's been another effect, and that is, if that's a road, a lot of the disposal of radioactives and dangerous things have been done along roads. Tanker trucks simply open the valves of substances and travel the roads at night. So many hundreds of miles of roads are radioactive. I've often watched people going around these fire extinguishers, emptying them out down sewers, and then refilling them. And I took a photograph of the guy doing it. Just came out of a garage, just squirted the whole lot into the gutter and went back in and put new extinguishers in, and away goes your dioxins. And also, of course, nowadays the transformers in hydroelectric systems have a lot of dioxin in too. So they are periodically renewed or break down and get dumped out. And all these things are in the groundwaters. Now, when you come to pump out of the groundwater, you can't. And not only can you not, but you will not be able to ever again. In terms of health, mainly, so this cycle is this one. That's one cycle. The other cycle is the manufacture of those substances in factories in the AD world. Their export to the third world, which is a massive export. The growing of crops in the third world, always for consumption. So there's your other cycle. PCBs and things travel out from the overdeveloped countries to plantation crop in the third world and are re-imported as food.
An example of that is DDT, which is banned in the United States, but not in Mexico. But the United States, of course, eats most of Mexico's pineapples and fruits.
And all of its tomatoes, I think. And although the substances aren't banned in Mexico, they are brought into the United States because Mexico is the main food producer of America these days. They used to import the Mexicans and grow the food in the United States and found it cheaper to leave the Mexicans at home bring the food in. The other cycle is an aerial cycle. Some of these things co-distill or release as aerosols and fall as rain. Now between those three, between the acid rain effects, the soil infiltration effects, the export of chemicals and export of radioactives by air to the third world and their re-import as food, you've set up three cycles of poison. If you come to test your foods, for instance in Canberra, you'll find that there's not a single plant sold in Canberra not loaded to the ears with cadmium. So many times the health limits that they won't even mention it.
Where is it?
In Canberra, ACT.
Oh,
Australia, the capital city.
That's the plant.
Your plant's on sale in the shops.
A vegetable shop.
The reason for that is that all superphosphate contains fairly high levels of cadmium. All superphosphate. And that continual application of superphosphate and the cadmium accumulates in the crops. So again, it's this cycle that we're talking about here. Now, that fact was known in Canberra in 1975, 76, but it's not ever been released. The Department of Plant Industry did the measurements and the guys got demoted. And a secrecy thing was put on the results. A clamp.
Is rock phosphate reduced instead of being the same?
You still get a lot of cadmium in some rock phosphate, but some you don't. Depends on which rock phosphate. South Australian stuff's no good.
Do you know which?
No, but you can find out by test.
What's the actual effect on human rock
cadmium? Death is from pneumonia. A breakdown is the kidney and kidneys mainly, and lung tissue, I think. Lung tissue. Usual death is ascribed to a lung disease. It's extremely painful death. It's called itai, or I hurt. It's a Japanese name for cadmium poisoning. It's very difficult to eliminate most heavy metals because they are accepted by the body very much like calcium and built mainly into bones, but sometimes, like cadmium, is built mainly into organ tissue. Mercury into nervous tissue. So each taken up a bit differentially by the body. Mercury causes mental breakdown. Suicide effects. Lead is also a very depressing effect. Alters the ability of the long bones to make blood. 38% of city children have elevated lead levels from motor vehicle exhaust. Right, so we have a little problem with drinking water. The United States in 17 states have now started to measure their groundwaters. Nobody's coming out with any that you can drink yet.